I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's August 8th, and we have a lot to talk about. And today, it's my pleasure and privilege to be talking with Dr. Stephen Hauser. Dr. Hauser's cutting-edge research as a physician scientist has revolutionized our understanding of the genetics, immunology, and treatment of MS, and led to the development of B-cell therapy, which has proven itself to be highly effective in treating all forms of MS and the only therapy approved for treating progressive MS. Dr. Hauser is a recipient of virtually every major award presented in the field of MS research, including the John Distel Prize, the Charcot Award, and the Scientific Breakthrough Award from the American Brain Foundation. Now, Dr. Hauser has written a memoir entitled The Face Laughs While the Brain Cries, The Education of a Doctor. But Dr. Hauser's memoir goes well beyond the expected autobiography. It offers the reader an opportunity to really see the process of scientific discovery, specifically as it relates to MS research. If you're curious about how we know what we know about multiple sclerosis, but you aren't interested in trying to make your way through the dry prose of a research journal, this is the book for you. I found it absolutely fascinating. But before we get to my conversation with Dr. Stephen Hauser, there are a few other things that you should know about. The World Health Organization has added three disease-modifying therapies for MS onto its essential medicines list. The three DMTs are rituximab, cladribine, and glatiramer acetate. You may know these three disease-modifying therapies by their brand names, Rituxan, Mavenclad, and Copaxone. The WHO's essential medicines list is an internationally recognized set of selected medicines to help countries choose how to treat their priority health needs. Countries frequently use the list to develop their own national lists of essential medicines. Now, this is the first time that MS disease-modifying therapies have been included on the WHO's essential medicines list, and that sends a powerful message to governments and regulators around the world that MS treatments are safe and effective, and they should be made available to those who could benefit from them. It represents a major step toward improving access to MS treatments for people living with MS, particularly those living in low- and middle-income countries who face significant barriers trying to access even the most basic MS treatments. The WHO's landmark decision is the direct result of a years-long effort by the MS International Federation and its members to have MS disease-modifying therapies included on this list. The MSIF has pointed out that while the three DMTs being added represent a baseline of care, they lay a foundation for better access to all of the MS disease-modifying therapies for people living with MS around the world. Congratulations to the MS International Federation and its members for staying in the fight until it was won and improving access to disease-modifying therapies for people living with MS, especially in low- and middle-income countries. If you'd like to review the MS International Federation's statement on this landmark decision by the WHO, you'll find a link in today's show notes. When someone is diagnosed with MS, their neurologist talks to them about disease-modifying therapy and hopefully stresses that starting a DMT early is important. Well, now a research team led by Dr. Mar Tintori and Dr. Xavier Montalban at the Multiple Sclerosis Center of Catalonia and the Autonomous University of Barcelona has published results of a study that provides additional evidence that beginning treatment within 6 months of the first MS symptoms, delays progression. This study involved 580 people who had experienced a single episode of MS symptoms. The study participants were either treated with a DMT within 6 months after that first episode, or between 6 and 12 months of that first episode, or after 16 months. And the research team followed these individuals with MRI scans and clinical exams for an average of 11 years. Then the team analyzed the time it took the study participants to progress to an EDSS score indicating moderate disability. Now, as a quick refresher, EDSS is an acronym for Expanded Disability Status Score. It's a scoring system of between 0 and 10 that neurologists use to characterize the level of disability in someone living with MS. The researchers also looked at the time it took each study participant in each of these groups to develop secondary progressive MS, which is a stage of MS that involves steadily worsening disability. The study results show that, on average, people who were treated with a DMT within 6 months of their first episode of MS symptoms had a 45% lower risk of reaching moderate disability than those treated after 16 months. Those treated within 6 months also had a 60% lower risk of developing secondary progressive MS than people treated after 16 months. And no significant findings were reported for that group treated between 6 and 16 months. The results of this study offer important evidence that early treatment can make a significant difference in your quality of life for years to come. And it points to one more reason why getting an accurate MS diagnosis as early as possible is so important. If you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. I want to remind you that the 15th annual Burgers to Beat MS Day is taking place Thursday, August 17th at A&W locations across Canada. For those of you living in Canada or those of you with plans to be in Canada on August 17th, A&W will donate $2 for every teen burger sold to support the work of MS Canada. Canada has one of the highest rates of MS in the world. Every day, 12 more Canadians are told, "You have MS." Over the past 14 years, A&W has raised over $19 million to support research, programs, and services for Canadians living with MS. This year's fundraising goal is $2 million. And if you'd like to participate, but you don't want to wait until August 17th, or you don't happen to live in Canada, you can visit burgerstobeatms.ca and make your online donation today. You'll find that link in today's show notes. Burgers to Beat MS helps support MS research, and my guest today is one of the foremost MS researchers in the world. In a moment, we'll meet Dr. Stephen Hauser. Dr. Steve Hauser is a distinguished professor of neurology at the University of California, San Francisco, and director of the Weill Institute of Neurosciences. His cutting-edge research as a physician scientist has revolutionized our understanding of the genetics, immunology, and treatment of MS, and led to the development of B-cell therapy, which has proven itself to be highly effective in treating all forms of MS, and the only therapy approved for treating progressive MS. Among the many awards acknowledging his work, Dr. Hauser has been honored as the recipient of the John Distel Prize, the Charcot Award, and the Scientific Breakthrough Award from the American Brain Foundation. Now, Dr. Hauser has written a memoir entitled "The Face Laughs While the Brain Cries: The Education of a Doctor." Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Hauser.
Hello, John. Thank you for inviting me.
As a memoir, we would expect this book to be autobiographical, and it certainly is, but your book also offers readers who may not be involved in science an opportunity to really see the process of scientific discovery, in this case, as it relates to MS research. Was that one of your goals in writing the book?
Yes, absolutely. An important theme for me was to tell the story of medical discovery in the light of just how fragile it can be. Discoveries need to be nurtured, tested, often revised as information becomes available. Science needs patience and support. But when there is persistent efforts and wherewithal to make science continue, the results can be spectacular. And that certainly is what happened in MS and what is happening today. So above all, my hope that the book will increase the public's interest in and confidence in science, while also being engaging and fun to read.
You know, as a reader learns about your personal story, it becomes easier to perhaps understand how you found yourself focused on neurology and then more specifically on MS. Your interest in how the brain worked or why it didn't always work the same way for everyone was initially motivated by your younger brother, Howard, and then by the death of a childhood friend who passed away due to a brain tumor.
Yes. It was remarkable that in my childhood, diseases of the immune system and of the nervous system seemed to be all around me. And as I wrote the book, it began to write itself, particularly in the autobiographical section. And I was personally afflicted by immune diseases throughout my childhood and by neurologic diseases that seemed all around me. And as I wrote the book, I wondered how I could have become anything except a neuroimmunologist, a physician of diseases of the nervous system and the immune system.
But it was your experience with Andrea, a patient living with severe MS, that focused what's become your life's work on understanding multiple sclerosis and finding new and better treatments for MS. Andrea even inspired the title of your memoir, The Face Laughs, yes, While the Brain Cries. Can you tell me a bit about Andrea?
Yes. Andrea was a young woman who I met many years ago. She was 27 years old when I was 27 years old. But she was already extraordinarily accomplished until MS struck. And her first symptom was a very unusual one, a change in behavior, thought possibly psychiatric, even though there was nothing in her background to suggest this. Andrea carried on for a few weeks until one morning she awakened, unable to speak, and then over hours developed weakness on the right side of her body and lost the ability to swallow or even breathe on her own. Her family rushed her to our hospital. I was a resident then, just a physician in training. But I remember thinking that this was the most unfair thing I had ever seen in medicine. And that was how my journey to try to understand and possibly treat MS more effectively began.
What a journey it's been. One theme that runs through your book is how advances in technology enabled your research to move forward. In writing about your remarkable work related to studying DNA, you point out that in the 1990s, there were approximately 300 genetic markers available to search for differences in individuals. A decade later, the number of markers had grown to over a million. And today you point out that all 3 billion DNA building blocks can be identified in any DNA sample quickly and at a low cost. It was eye-opening for me to learn that when you published the first full DNA sequence of several people with MS, and this was in 2009, the cost was nearly $1 million per person. And then just 10 years later, the cost of the same analysis had been reduced to less than $1,000. You know, I often talk about technology as the engine that drives the future. Can you talk about how advances in technology have impacted MS research today and what some of these advances might mean, maybe in the near or midterm future.
It's advances in technology, as you say, that have been the drivers of progress for MS. And even more important, connecting the technology to patients and their real bedside problems as quickly as possible and as efficiently as possible. You mentioned the genetic story very beautifully, John. And I think another part of the genetic study that to me is even more shocking is that not only can we sequence 3 billion building blocks very cheaply, but high school students doing summer internships can now do this in our laboratories. And these are advances of technology. The modern era of MS trials was enabled by MRI technology. When my career began in the 1970s, the MRI wasn't even a rumor. The science behind MRI technology, though, was 60 years old. It was in use by industry, but not in medicine. And it was the bringing of that technology to human beings and medical problems that really launched the MS modern era. Technologies that let us today, in a parallel fashion, screen for the allergies that are 10 million different types of immune cells are reacting against in a parallel way over the course of an hour or two, will transform our understanding of exactly how the immune response has changed in people with MS that leads to the immune system misbehaving and reacting not against only foreign invaders, but also against our myelin and nerve cells in the brain. And using this technology, it's already become clear that an immune signature can be easily identified years before MS begins. Imagine that. We can now see the autoimmune or abnormal immune process beginning years before MS begins. We now can only see this image in about 10 or 15% of people who will go on to develop MS. But this is going to enlarge with artificial intelligence and machine learning and even better technologies to interrogate our immune system in the peripheral blood to tell us what it's doing in our nervous system. So I think the promise of a variety of technologies, not only engineering like imaging and genetic and immune technologies to solve progressive MS, is truly spectacular. And to me, the MRI example is a lesson, not only in opportunity, but in challenges. We cannot let 60 years happen before those technologies are not applied to MS and other important diseases. We need to move as quickly and efficiently as possible.
Could actually bring me to my next question. In your book, you write about your research into cyclophosphamide as a potential treatment for MS. Ultimately, it didn't prove to have lasting effect, but one of the patients in the study, a 25-year-old Vietnam veteran who had been diagnosed with MS at the age of 19, told you, and I'm quoting now, "Even though it didn't work, I'm still glad that we tried. Just being in the study gave me new hope." And the reason I wanted to mention that particular quote is because today we find ourselves in an era when there's more unfounded skepticism of science than we've experienced probably in the last 100 years, certainly in the last several decades. What would you say to people living with MS who may feel maybe hesitant about participating in clinical research?
We learn more about disease from our bedside experience than from all the laboratory work that has been done. But the real advances have come when the bedside learning and the laboratories are brought together. And that has been the story of progress against MS, which is one of the great success stories in medicine. We're only halfway home, but I am confident that progressive MS and even cure is going to be a realistic goal for our lifetime. I think that the thousands of patients who have courageously trusted in science and in the medical system and their physicians, and who have agreed to participate in the clinical trials that have led to these discoveries and advances, are enormously courageous. And they are also our essential partners if we're going to make progress. So some people are very motivated to participate in experiments. And these are experiments that can advance the understanding of not only their disease, but a disease that affects millions of others. Whereas others are more reticent or cautious. And there is room, of course, for both, for all of us in the MS discovery effort. But it is the patients who have trusted in us and have been willing to put themselves at risk to advance the field. They are the real heroes of the MS research effort.
A moment ago, I mentioned the cyclophosphamide clinical trial, and while it ultimately proved not to be a durable long-term treatment, you still learned something very important in that trial. You proved that suppressing the immune system could stop MS for a period of time. Now, in the non-scientific world, we often define successes or failures in absolute terms, like the final score of a sports contest. One team gets a win, another team gets a loss. But scientists can learn a lot, even when their studies fall short of reaching that final endpoint, can't they?
That is true, John. The MS debate at the time was whether MS is somehow caused by an infectious agent, a virus or a bacteria. Or was MS caused by an allergic reaction? And what the cyclophosphamide studies taught us is that it is this immune, allergic, or autoimmune reaction and an overactive immune system that is at the root of causing MS. This is also almost certainly why MS has increased in recent years in prevalence, because the instigation for this autoimmune reaction is coming from environmental factors that have changed as we have moved from small farms to larger cities to huge urban areas.
I found your entire book fascinating, and certainly anyone who's on a disease-modifying therapy for MS will especially appreciate the story, the many steps leading to the development of a B-cell therapy that has been shown to be highly effective in managing MS. It's truly been a life changer for hundreds of thousands of people. Can you tell us a bit about what that experience was like for you?
Yes, this was a long journey, and it began with the recognition that the laboratory models that we were using, a disease model is a laboratory animal or cells in a test tube that we think are similar to the problem that is causing illness in a person. That is a laboratory model. And in MS, the main laboratory model were mice who were allergic to their myelin, because they were immunized or vaccinated with myelin tissue. And that was a model called EAE, which is still in broad use today. And EAE, we know from mouse experiments, is caused by a type of lymphocyte called a thymus or T lymphocyte, or a T cell. And T cells cause EAE, case closed. And we know that because you can take T cells from a mouse with EAE and transfer the disease to a littermate mouse who was healthy with just T cells. So the idea was in the community that T cells had to cause MS because they caused this inflammation in the brains of mice. But the tissue changes in those mice look nothing like the tissue changes that were present in our patients with MS. So my career began with an effort to try to create a pattern of tissue damage in the laboratory that resembled what was really happening in people with MS. And that led us, as you know from the book, to a almost blasphemous discovery at the time, that it was a very minor cell, not a T cell, but a cell called a B cell. B cells give rise to cells that make chemical bullets called antibodies. That it was the B cell that we thought created a model that had greater fidelity to human MS. And that led us to then re-examine the real tissue from people who had MS. And we had biopsy tissue and in some cases autopsy tissue, and found for the first time B cells and their antibody messengers associated with the myelin damage that was occurring. So we then went to the normal funders of research, government funders, to ask to try to treat people with MS with a therapy that was against B cells rather than T cells. And we were met with a response that this was biologically implausible, that T cells cause MS. The government will fund T cell work, but not B cell work. And it was industry that took the large bet against conventional wisdom. As the CEO of Genentech said, because patients need this, and why are we in business if we can't do something like this? And I think the MS story is also, for me, a very beautiful story, because it shows that everyone needs to be in it together for medical research to be as effective as possible. Our skills and our contributions are almost non-overlapping. We each contribute something essential and critical: patients, scientists, and industry, along with philanthropists and foundations and government support for research. But when it is all working together, it's really a magnificent thing.
Well, the name of the book is The Face Laughs While the Brain Cries, The Education of a Doctor. It's available at Amazon, and I have absolutely no doubt that the listeners of this podcast will appreciate the book every bit as much as I did. Dr. Steve Hauser, thank you for your remarkable body of work and all you continue to do to improve the lives of people living with MS. And thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you so much, John. It was my pleasure.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/310. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or a text. And if you have a minute, I hope you'll visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free RealTalk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the best way for us to stay connected. The app will automatically download the latest episode of RealTalk MS. You'll be able to access any of our past episodes. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes. And it's a great way for me to share bonus content with you. The app is free, so I hope you'll download it today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.